Hi, and welcome to Song Divers, an interview podcast about singer-songwriters.
We like to go deep in conversation with our favorite musicians in search of honest answers.
What are the ingredients of a great song?
What makes a songwriter tick?
Can a musician make a living these days?
Is Jason Isbell overrated?
What?
My name is Stefan.
And this is Ed.
And we're thrilled to finally bring you our first episode with a female singer-songwriter.
Hello, my name is Lydia Luce. Hello, lonesome, I'm breaking free. Oh, I do not like the way you've treated me. Upon my mountain, I look ahead. Feeling grounded with each and every step, each and every step.
Equal parts nature and nurture, Lydia Luce has an instinct for songwriting. Her artistic voice is both beautiful and unique, and her lyrics hint at an appreciation and curiosity for the world around us. Her almost flower child attitude is counterbalanced by an innocent professionalism and a perfectly applied polish from her years of musical conservatory-based study. From the string sections she spearheads to her own songwriting, there's a grateful but confident practice at work in everything she seems to touch. If you're like us, once you hear her, her tunes will be in your weekly playlist. Where are you from? Where'd you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Fort Lauderdale, but I moved from there when I was 18, so I haven't been there in a while, and then I've been really bouncing around a ton since then.
And where are you based now?
I live in Nashville now. I've been there for 2.5 years. I moved from Los Angeles, way different vibes. And then before that, I worked at the Smithsonian for a year.
What'd you do there?
I was working at Folkways.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if you've heard of Folkways Records. It's
yes.
Like the Smithsonian's...
The archives
yeah.
of the Lomax field recordings and all that. Yeah.
You know, he yeah. knows. Yeah, so I thought I was going to be an ethnomusicologist at one point. And I ended up there, it was really cool. It was a really awesome opportunity, but I was like at a desk for
right.
8 or 9 hours a day, and halfway through that, I was like, I need to be playing, and so that's what led me to UCLA for grad school. But it was cool. I mean, their archive was incredible. Like they had all Pete Seeger stuff
yeah.
and Woody mm. Guthrie, and mm-hmm. I got to listen to like. So much music that I just had never...
What exactly heard. Were your duties there? Like, what were you doing? Like,
different things, but I would look in the archives for royalty. I would, like, track down whoever was supposed to get their royalties, like Lead Belly's family
oh, yeah.
members.
Oh, wow.
That
right.
was really cool and crazy. And then one of the cooler things I got to do was UNESCO donated 120 records to the Smithsonian, to Folkways. And so we were going to release them that following year. So I had to go through and listen to about like 45 of them, and then wrote out, like read the liner notes, wrote out blurbs for the website.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to know like this music, like Inuit music, and like just music that I would have probably not listened to, and like especially very intently, if not for that job. So, and some of it was kind of hard to listen to.
Like, yeah,
like straight through a whole record of like just really out stuff.
But it's interesting because there were guys like Lomax
yeah.
going out into the field and recording this for posterity, like this
yeah.
cultural.
And see, like, that's what I wanted to do.
You wanted to be in the field?
That was in like, my mind. I was like, oh, I'm going to do ethnomusicology. I'm going to mm-hmm. explore. And I had gone to, in my undergrad, I had gone to Ghana 2 different summers and spent a month there both times. And actually did study like the dance and drum and learned so much. And then I gave a couple like lectures on that. And so I thought I wanted to just do that, and that would be, but Ghana has, like the music of Ghana has been explored immensely, and a lot of other cultures have had people like since Lomax come in and explore their music and mm-hmm. and then write about it. And so it was kind of the what I could have learned and what I could have specialized in was just really limited.
It wasn't pioneering. It was more like sorting and synthesizing.
Yeah. And now a lot of ethnomusicologists are like studying computer music and like synth stuff or like what music is going to. So so I decided to play the viola.
Good yeah. choice.
But yeah. with some influence, right? I mean, you were raised in a very musical family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mom's a classical conductor. And my parents have been so supportive of, like, I knew I wanted to do music in high school. And I was kind of on the track for, like, classical violin. Like, I went to, like, orchestra camps and did all the auditions. My first college was, like, a conservatory and switched to viola. And it's a really intense life. It's lonely in a way. Mm. Like, you're practicing by yourself. There's not, like, the...
How many hours a day would you say?
At one point, I was practicing, like, 8 hours a day.
Right.
Like, when I was at my... the conservatory, I was probably playing 8 hours a day and practicing, like, 4 of them. Because you have to. Like,
right.
Everybody's so good, and you just want to... Mm-hmm. Everybody else is practicing that much, too.
Yeah.
It's so lonely. Like, you're just...
And the end goal is to land a chair in an orchestra somewhere,
exactly.
right? Like,
mm-hmm. yeah.
So you have to be competitive. And
there aren't that many chairs
like, yeah, right.
to land a position like that in. So, and I realized that pretty early on and then was interested in other things musically. And so kind of I was interested in creating more and writing and doing just something different. And so...
Talk about that. Talk about, yeah. like, influences, maybe? Like, what
yeah.
what was your interest that drove you to do what you're doing?
When I was at the conservatory, I was writing little songs on my viola and singing and playing, and I started playing, like, some open mics, and I was like, nobody does this, and...
With a viola?
Yeah, yeah. singing and playing, and then I discovered, like, Ben Soli and there are several singer-songwriters that do that, like Andrew Bird and
right.
different...
Andrew Bird's great.
Yeah, so incredible. He actually went to a conservatory as well.
I read that,
also was like, no. Because there's not... You want... Part of the beautiful thing about music is the camaraderie and being mm-hmm. able to... The community and being able to do things together, so... this chick Annie Rossi, I discovered her when I was like pretty young. She plays viola and sings, and just was really interested in doing more of that. And then I left the conservatory and then just kind of like took a year off and was like, what am I doing? And then heard about Berklee. Somebody told me about Berklee when I was like 19 and ended up going there, and that kind of completely opened up my musical, like, the education I thought I could get in music was like conservatory.
Mm-hmm.
And this was so just everything in one, under one roof. Mm-hmm. Anything I wanted to do, songwriting, ethnomusicology. I studied like Middle Eastern fiddle. I had musical ADD. I did all the things and then kind of tried to hone in on, okay, what's next after I graduated. And it's just been several years of, okay, well, that I liked, but I kind of want to push it in this direction, like kind of just navigating my musical career, always doing it, but mm-hmm. It's looked like so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
Was Berklee also more of that camaraderie you were looking for?
Oh,
was it more
absolutely.
Of a, like a melting pot and kind
yeah.
of sparking off of other, like...
Yeah.
musicians in the same boat as you.
Yeah,
like,
jamming. We
yeah.
jammed a lot mm-hmm. to the point where, like, if somebody asked if you wanted to jam, they're like, no. I don't want to jam. I'm upper class Berklee. I don't jam anymore. But when you first get there, you're like, yeah, let's jam. And
at one point, did you pick up a guitar and start learning
yeah.
that and using that as an accompaniment?
I had taught myself in high school, just like, you know, Blackbird and Tabs. My mom would never, she didn't want me to like take lessons. She wanted me to do just like violin and viola stuff. So I had to do, just learn myself. And yeah, and then kind of started incorporating it more at Berklee, because I took songwriting classes and like no one else was bringing their viola in. Though it would have been very cool, because the viola is very cool.
It is a beautiful instrument.
Yeah.
Do you have it with you on the road? Or just the violin?
Just the violin.
Yeah.
My viola is really nice, and I don't have a great pickup for it, and mm-hmm. it's just easier to bring the violin. My violin I got for free. It was my great-grandfather's. He just like used to collect instruments, and we found it in his closet when we were selling his house.
Wait.
And it's awesome, and it's called a Stradivarius, not a Stradivarius.
Not to be confused with.
Yeah. It's a German factory violin, which is actually, they make, German factory violins are pretty nice, but it says Stradivarius inside, and a couple of people have been like, oh my gosh, you have a Strad? I'm like, yeah. Totally.
Technically, yes.
Is that a Gibson? This is a Gibson.
Yes, exactly.
So after Berklee, where did that take you after that? So you're still kind of trying to figure out what you want to do or how you want to approach it? Or
yeah, I thought I wanted to. I was.
And how many years ago is this? Give some context for listeners.
Yeah, this was many moons ago. This was in like 2013, 14.
Okay.
So I left Berklee and was still doing the violin, viola thing. So I was like playing with other artists and doing that. And then also looking at what a ethnomusicology career would look like. So I got to play with Rod Stewart the year I graduated.
Oh my gosh.
And like Annie Lennox and.
So was he touring with a small string?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we played like three shows with him, and then and Santana was opening for him. It was pretty like, oh, this is an interesting. It was just a pretty. It was like right after Berklee, so it was like, this is what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And then went straight to the Smithsonian, and then out to LA. And since then, I've gotten to play a lot. Like I do a lot of different things, so I still do a lot of like violin, viola things, and I've gotten to play with some really cool artists and in some sessions with some cool artists, and so it's been fun to have that side too, where I'm just supporting another artist purely mm-hmm. and not focusing on like Lenny Lewis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's actually great. I love doing that.
Well, when did you start doing the Lenny Lewis thing? Like, when did you first start writing?
I mean, I did it at Berklee, but I was less serious about it. I started getting serious about it like halfway through UCLA.
And what was the catalyst? Was it that you felt like you had something to say? Was it expressive? Was it cathartic? Was it just time?
Yeah. I mean, it was like I kind of entered back into that conservatory thing at UCLA. It was super. I'd gone from Berklee where you just could like create and be weird and whatever and do your own thing, and then back to this super academically driven community and
rigid and, discipline
and, yes yeah. And I went in kind of like with a different idea of what I was trying to do, and so it was pretty strict the first year, and then towards the end of that something happened. I think there was like a performance that I'd worked my butt off for and was like, man, that wasn't even fun. And started writing more, and I was playing a couple shows out, and then I made an EP. I moved to Nashville. I went on a tour playing fiddle with a songwriter and was like, I want to be doing what this guy's doing. This is fun. I want to be playing my songs and try that. So I got back and moved to Nashville, wrote a bunch, and then finished my degree, but went back that second year and was like, all right, guys, I got to do it differently. Like, this isn't what I want to do. I either leave or, because I was also teaching for UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
So my boss was really cool. Like, he was like, all right, we want you to be here. What does that look like for you? So I ended up teaching a class about like, strings in the real world, kind of mm-hmm. like if you don't get a job as you know that one
mm-hmm.
Seat in an orchestra, Like, what else can you do?
Right. Recording sessions.
Yeah. There's so many other things, and they're really satisfying and utilize all your education from your undergrad, your graduate degree, and still, I don't know. So it just like, it can look like different things.
So when you went to Nashville, it was just like a cold, like, I'm going to Nashville?
I was going to ask that too. Yeah. I mean, Andrew had a moment like that he mentioned, Andrew Duhon, who you just finished up a tour with.
Yes.
We just did a session with as well. And he talked about having this, like, I know this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And I can think of so many of my friends that would not just be like, I'm moving to Nashville. I'm picking up moving to Nashville. Yeah. So to Ed's point, I mean, it's just a clean, like, I'm doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was just for the summer, and I really loved that tour I was on, and all those guys lived in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I want to be with them doing what they're doing, and found a room from, I think, Facebook. Like, this room, it's this tiny little room in a house with three dudes that were all musicians, and they had a Rottweiler that did not like girls. And so I just kind of like, I was like, I'm
That's
doing
me.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Told my mom, and she's like, why do you keep doing this to me? But it was fine. She warmed up to me. But yeah, it was a great summer. I learned a lot. I kind of became more comfortable with my voice, and I went to a jazz fiddle camp that summer too, because I was still in that classical world. So I was like, okay, let me. And a bunch of my friends from Berkeley went to this camp. It's called Creative Strings, and it's like the best jazz violinists, like just amazing string players, like, in the world. Like, a lot of people come to this camp,
mm-hmm.
and I was there. And I didn't study jazz growing up. I did at Berkeley a little bit, but I was like thrown in there, and was like, well, this is really different, and started singing. That, like, we would do a lot of standards, and I would play in different groups, and that's when I started singing more, because I was like, I don't want to take all the solos. I'll take like a little solo, and then you guys go do it, but I'll sing the standard instead, and got really comfortable doing that. And so it kind of just trickled into this.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I like doing this. I like singing. I like writing. I like performing on that side, and figuring out what worked
mm-hmm.
for me.
And it sounds like you had a community already there that you were moving to be with.
Yeah.
But did you find so many people moved to Nashville? Did you find that community welcoming to you? Like, did you find it super hard to break in? Certainly you had an in because there's a group living there, but.
Yeah. No, I felt it really welcoming. Like, when I moved there, I started this house show series. Like, I think Martin and I had actually driven across the country, got there. The next night I had a house show
mm-hmm.
in my house, and there are 15 people there. And it was like my singer-songwriter friends, but I was like, I just want to do it. I was so pumped to be in Nashville. And then like 2.5 years later, now that the house show community is that specific one has grown so much. Now there's 90 people at my house, and I can't do them at my house anymore because they're so big. And the last one we did was like NPR mentioned it, and they're in one of their radio segments, and also wrote an article about it. And
that's the dream.
Yeah.
Well, now they're even doing. My daughter and I were walking through downtown Nashville, and there's a billboard like they have. It's house concert, but it's in an arena. Like, how do they do that? That's not a house concert. Like,
I don't know about that.
They're trying to tap into, like...
Who lives there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the idea of the... It's kind of turned more into, like... Because I'm doing them less at my house. I'm trying to figure out a way to do every like, several months at my house to keep it special. Like, that is a really special environment.
Mm-hmm.
But then also doing them at other venues. And it's more just keeping it intimate and keeping it that listening environment where the performers are like, I love curating the show. So if I'm like, oh, that person's going to love that person, maybe they can work together, creating an environment that is community building by just having a bill that's like, you know, songwriters that have a lot in common that I think might be homies.
Sounds like a little bit of an extension of the Bluebird Cafe kind of
vibe,
where people are showcasing the songwriters, but they're also kind of sparking off each other and building
Yeah. And then it's also, so the special thing about it is the artists are backed by string quartet or whatever. It's called Lachlan Strings. And
are you part of the, are you one of them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I it's just grown like so quickly. And yeah, I play viola in it when I can. And it's turned into like a contracting thing now too. Like if an artist needs strings, they call me and they're like, we need the Lachlan Strings. And really it's just my friends.
There's
not
great,
like,
though.
I'm like,
that's...
yeah, it's so fun. And we now also have an in-house arranger. So if an artist is like, I want to play, but I don't have arrangements. So it's also helping my community, you know, pay bills.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think it's important. We're all growing together,
mm-hmm.
but it's definitely kind of taken off. And it's also, it's singer songwriters, but then also local composers that are producers, arrangers, whatever, but also write really cool arrangements and mm-hmm. don't have a platform to play them. So it's all of those things.
Yeah, you're serving a lot of needs.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I feel that because I felt the need when I was there. I didn't. There's a contemporary classical scene, but it's small and it's like the symphony and those audience members, and then now there's become like through Lachlan Strings and then other kind of organizations that have come up in the past 2 years. They're like same people basically, but through those we're creating our own audience and mm-hmm. trying to bridge those.
I was gonna say it sounds like a bridge between the two.
Yeah. Like the last one we did, usually the house shows are younger people, like my age, younger, but
can you give us an age range there?
Yes. Like people in their 20s, 30s.
Okay.
And so this last one, I overheard this older woman saying like, oh my gosh, there's so many young people here, and we're all like, oh my gosh, there's so many like older people here. This is such a cool, like, I don't know, just community that's mm-hmm. it's all ages, it's we're all looking for the same thing, mm-hmm. and it's affordable, it's intimate, it's not like $150 to go see the symphony.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds super special for many reasons, you know, one of which is that you're doing something it sounds like you genuinely want to be doing for enjoyment. You enjoy playing, you enjoy arranging, mm-hmm. you're getting to do a lot of different versions of that. But also, you know, you can be a good songwriter, but so much of music these days is, I don't want to call it networking, but it is. It's building a community to support what you're doing and vice versa. And so how much, if there was any intention in that, or if it's just a nice byproduct, that it's perpetuating what you're doing as a solo artist?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think about that every time, for sure. It's really helpful. And it's provided me with opportunities that I might not have had, and I've met people that I might not have met, and I get to curate the bill. So if I'm like, I don't know if I get to play a show with that person, but I really love what they're doing, I'm just going to ask them to play my show. And so that alone, yes, it has turned into like a organic, I hate the word networking sometimes, but
yeah.
You know, it is community building.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's, depending on like, you know, your objective, I guess, but mm-hmm. it is totally also benefiting the Lenia Loose artist thing.
Lenia Loose.
I feel that I have to say
Lenia
it.
Lenia Loose.
Like Groucho Marx would say.
It's funny you mentioned Groucho Marx. I'm not going to go there. This will not end up in the podcast.
Are you going to sing Lydia the Tattoo
Lady? Lydia, oh Lydia. Have you seen Lydia? Sorry.
Oh, I know it. I know it so well.
No, I'm gonna veto the cut on that.
Please,
I like that.
Please keep that.
Yeah.
That was no. That's I love that. That's like one of the only Lydia songs. That's
the
out
tattooed
there.
Lady.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, it's, since we got to your name, we just had presumably a listener reach out to us on social media. You're our first female artist, so thank you for doing that.
Amazing.
Yeah, our first female episode, and the young lady that reached out, Lydia, was in her like her account name, and so when she said hey, she basically reached out and said, hey, I'm really enjoying the podcast, are you guys gonna have any female artists on, like I feel like we're underrepresented, and I, you know, I'd like to hear someone. Said actually, not only are we having one on, at least looks
we
like you guys
you're
the same thing. So that was really, really
awesome.
Interesting just since you brought up the name piece. There's more Lydias than maybe you're aware.
Maybe. We should all band together. Just like the violists in the world. If you can hear me now.
Well, so it sounds like you have a really wide cross-section of music that you're not just aware of, but that you've heard and mm-hmm. and had to absorb. What do you listen to for enjoyment, or do you? Some people
can't. Yeah. I do, absolutely. It depends on, like, what my need is, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I listen to a lot of contemporary classical music, and I listen to a lot of, like...
And are you swaying, or are you hearing all the notes, and are you hearing all the, like... Are you studying it while you're listening, or can you unplug?
I can unplug. Like, my mom used to always say that. She would say she could never turn her brain off when she would listen to, like, classical music. But I can totally do that. And I do. Like,
she's a conductor, so I can get it more with her, probably.
I used to watch her study scores. And I was just like, no way, never. She's like, big pieces where it's just...
She knows where the triangle comes in, measure 222.
Yeah. I don't know. That hasn't... I guess sometimes... I do more with lyrics, I guess. Maybe mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, that's really cool.
Right.
But not... I don't do that with, like, with contemporary classical music. I love, like, Philip Glass, Terry Riley. I just got to hear the Kronos Quartet, and it was so awesome. It was so cool. And yeah, I have been wanting to see them forever. And they played Philip Glass and Terry Riley. It was live to a documentary about their careers. And I guess I've known about them, but they were so like punk rock and mm-hmm. so totally changed like the string quartet game. Like they didn't want to wear, you know, they didn't want to look like penguins.
Kronos.
Yeah. They want to look like punk rockers mm-hmm. when they play. And they were so cool. I was really inspired by that. But yeah, and I listen to, I don't know, all different things. I love like Nick Drake and...
I was going to say, I poked Ed. So we were at your show last night, which was fantastic.
Thank you.
But I remember poking at him like, this sounds like a Nick Drake tune. I think it was Strawberry Moon.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which I like...
But it doesn't sound like Pink Moon.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It's a coincidence. It doesn't. Yeah. But there isn't that essence in there, which I absolutely loved. And I thought it was really interesting, too, because you mentioned in the beginning of your show, and we'll get into songwriting here, a lot of your songs have a somberness to them, mm-hmm. you know? And then you played three in a row that were just these, like, open chord... Yeah. You know, positive, happy, major feels. And I was like, and I felt a bunch of different things channeling through there, but that one specifically, Nick Drake, definitely mm-hmm. resonated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's definitely somber, but I think
beautifully somber.
Yeah. No, totally. I agree. I think that one's like a happy, one of the happier songs, but it comes from a place of deep feeling, of being really aware of the things that maybe you weren't initially happy with, mm-hmm. but then you got there through taking time to deeply feel the things that you're feeling and not run from them, mm-hmm. and then embracing them and growing from them. And I feel like that whole record, I did a lot of that, trying to. And then, you know, the next one, you have to do it again. You're like, oh, how do I get back there?
Well, it sounds like you're very introspective in your writing. Like you seem to have command, for lack of a better term, of what you're writing about and your emotions. A lot of people, I think, are so often just working, like songwriting is working through the human condition, right?
Oh, yeah.
But you seem to maybe have a little bit more of an understanding of your own.
Yeah, I've been working on it, you know.
Lydia, do you remember the first song you wrote?
Yeah. Yes.
Can we hear it?
No.
Can anyone?
Never. Never. I did talk about it the other day at a show.
All right, we don't want to hear about your other shows. Gross.
Ew. No, like live. We were playing in Asheville and at the Grey Eagle, and I had seen Annie Rossi, the violist, play there, and I brought my viola to the show and was like, maybe I'll get to play a song for her. And I was really young. I was like 18.
I thought you were going to say you were going to get her to autograph it.
Oh, yeah. Gosh. Oh, my gosh. That gives me anxiety thinking about it. Don't touch my viola. But I got to play her this. I had written this song called Plastic Eyes. And it was so, like, thinking about it makes me giggle because it's just so silly. But it was like, it was just this dream I had where my eyes fell out and I was singing, played on the viola, and it's so weird.
Oh, man. Plastic eyes.
Like, it references olives, like how eyeballs look like olives. It gets weird. And mm-hmm. I played that. That was my first song. And she let me play it for her in the parking lot. And she was so nice. She was so nice. Like, mm-hmm. some people would be like, no,
she was like,
I'm going home.
I got to go now.
Yeah. Oh, olives? Weird songwriting choice.
We were going to ask you about your stance on drugs, but I think we got what we need.
Yes. I mean, you can probably already tell from my songwriting, too.
Well, I didn't want to make any assumptions. So when was the first song where you're like, hey, this is something. Like, this is something I want to pursue. And when was that sort of, I don't know if catalyst moment is the right term.
Yeah.
But do you have something in your catalog you still play that was an early?
Yeah, Love
like,
You
when
True.
When was the first one that made it?
I think Love You True is probably that one. Because I remember playing it for a couple of people and just getting so much feedback. It's such a weird thing of, songwriting's such a weird thing because sometimes you're like, I know that this is good, or like I feel good about this mm-hmm. song, like I feel like I've accomplished something.
Yes.
And then sometimes you're like, I think this is really bad, this sucks, like I'm the worst. And then somebody else is like, that's my favorite song.
Yes.
You're like, why? I don't get it. And then maybe a couple months later you're like, I love that song. That's just a weird thing. But I remember somebody, I wrote the song Love You True for my brother and his wife when they got married. And so maybe having that intention behind it, like, this is a gift, no pressure. I love this person. They'll love me through it, mm-hmm. even if they don't love the song, whatever. It was more of a gift of, like, sharing this thing that this craft with this person that I loved. And a lot of people really loved that song. And then
it's a great one.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then kind of, like, that was one of the first, that was on my old EP that was like 5 years ago and recorded in my buddy's house in mm-hmm. Nashville.
Well, since we're there, do you want to play that one?
Yeah, sure.
So before you get into the song, usually we talk about it after, but lyrically, can you talk a little bit about the perspective? So you wrote it for your brother. So in the song, and I noticed with a lot of your songs, there's an interesting, like the perspective's maybe changing a little bit, or it's not necessarily you. So are you writing like first person him viewing his wife? Are
you? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a line, it's definitely from my brother's perspective to his wife, and then it does switch in the last chorus mm-hmm. sometimes, and then sometimes I forget to switch it. But the last chorus, if it goes according to plan, mm-hmm. it changes to her perspective. Just like it's a promise, basically I'll hold, like, keep you grounded, and so the other person, like a wedding, like or when you get married, you're promising these things to mm-hmm. the other person. Mm-hmm. And the song references my brother. My mom gave him her diamond from her, like my dad's. She got another ring like later on, and so the first diamond that my dad had given her, that was the ring that he gave to my sister-in-law. Mm-hmm. So there's a reference to mother's ring.
I love that. I think it's so special. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's that.
Well, let's let everybody else hear it.
All right. Yeah. Well, it's the way you look tonight. I want to keep you by my side forever. Well, it's the way you pick me up, not just once or twice, but every time I fall. And I know beyond a shadow of a doubt I'll be here too. Rivers dry, our love will never drought. So take me to the chapel and wear my mother's ring. Well, follow me when I'm a wandering and teach me how to be. Well, keep me grounded, well, keep me still. It's you I choose forever. And love you true. Well, vision fair, my beating heart's delight. And the summer watching you sweeping down the aisle, my precious bride, I'm gonna say I do. So take me to the chapel and wear my mother's ring. And follow me when I'm a wandering and teach me how to be. Well, keep me grounded, well, keep me still. It's you I choose forever. Hello. Well, the tides, it will rise, but I'll be true. I will swim the seas for you in the darkest depths of blue. But we'll need you to swim the seas for me. Take me to the chapel, I'll wear your mother's ring. I'll follow you when you're wandering and teach you how to lead. I'll keep you grounded, you'll keep me still. It's you I choose forever.
That's beautiful.
That is.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's awesome.
I've tried not to cry multiple times. I'm not kidding.
Yay. It's okay to cry.
I know. No, I did last night. I was.
Thank you.
I love crying.
I did that because our photographer was standing on my foot, actually. The song's very beautiful.
Thank you.
And now, a quick interlude about one of the companies supporting this podcast. Ed, I think we can both agree that the best tasting songs are those that happen naturally.
That's true. Wait, you can't really taste a song, though. That part's not.
That's also true of the food we choose to consume, which is why our favorite new artist on the healthy protein charts is ButcherBox. 100% grass-fed beef delivered on dry ice to your door anywhere in the lower 48.
So, does that make Alaska like the upper...
Ed, just open the box. If you're into more genres than just beef, ButcherBox has you covered. They also deliver Alaskan wild sockeye salmon, free-range organic chicken.
Wow, there's got to be like 11 pounds of meat in here.
Heritage breed pork and special bacon.
Special bacon?
Special because it's free. Use code SONGDIVERS at checkout to get $20 off and free bacon in your first ButcherBox. And shipping's free too.
Special bacon and special shipping. That's special.
Now, can you grill as well as you can play guitar? Visit ButcherBox.com to order. One of the things that we've really enjoyed, you know, getting to listen to and study your music as we prep for this show, was hearing all of the changing perspectives in the way you approach your songwriting. There's a lot of name dropping, which is interesting too. And they're not necessarily, it sounds like some of them are not necessarily anybody in particular.
Oh, yeah.
Azalea, which is, you know, your, mm-hmm. one of your singles right now. You described during your show what that song's about. I don't know if you want to talk about that one a little bit, but
yeah.
You said it's about you, but obviously your name's not Azalea.
Yeah, that one is definitely about me. I think it's, like a lot of times I think I start a song and then I don't realize what it's about until it's maybe it's finished or I'm listening to it later on. Like it takes on new roles. I think that happens when you listen to, you know, different song, any song, you're like, hear it once and it might mean something to you at that point. And then later on, you're like, oh, I get that. So I think that song, it started off as, like I said last night, I was going on a solo camping trip and my mom hates it when I do that. And I still do it because it's important to me. But she was like, just call. I was on the way down. She was like, call me when you get home. So the first line of the song is, Azalea, won't you call me when you're home? It's cold out tonight and you're all alone. And then it kind of, it kind of like morphed into this song. I think Azalea is one character, but it's there's a narrator and then there's Azalea, but I think it's really one person. So it's kind of like this person that's maybe a little bit more insecure, doubting themselves, viewing this strong, free-spirited character and seeing all the things in them that they're lacking, that they want, but they can't get to. So for me, that's like those moments where I'm like feeling like myself and I'm confident and I'm free and I'm able to just lean into it and be there. And then there are those times where you're like I find when I'm having like an off day, week, month, whatever, then I'm like thinking about those times when I felt strong and what was happening around that time. Like, how do I get back there, basically? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of about being both. We're so complex and we can have so many different aspects of ourselves and like all the time in one day go through, you know, three different versions of ourselves.
That's a really interesting thought.
Can I quote my favorite couplet from that song?
Sure, yeah.
Which I think encapsulates what you're saying. Are you afraid of the dark or do you live by the light in your heart?
Yeah.
I love that.
Oh, yeah. It's a beautiful juxtaposition. Yeah.
Because I did know that it was about your mother in the solo camping trip.
Yeah.
But now that you explain that, that's in there too. Yeah. It's mm-hmm. kind of like a struggle between having the courage to follow the light, or do you just kind of play it safe and
being brave. It talks about being brave in there too. And mm-hmm. I think like there's so many, I like to kind of dive into things and take risky moves in life. And like, I haven't always done that for sure. But I think that there's this beautiful moment when you're feeling really afraid and you know you have to do something and you just dive in and do it, and then it's always so worth it and you grow so much from it. But it's a really terrifying thing to like change or go be brave and do something different and shake things up. And like that's really important to me, and trying to make sure that I'm not complacent and mm-hmm. always curious. And I think to stay curious, you have to take chances and risks and go be by yourself. Live life. And mm-hmm. It's easy to just kind of fall into routine and pattern. And I do that too. And I'm like, oh, why do I feel this way? Oh, wait, you need to go do something different. Go change it up.
Well, so, it's interesting too that you talked about, like, obviously community is very important to you, mm-hmm. and having that you know, mixture of influences and friends and support.
Yeah.
But then it's also important to you. You talked about having some solitude.
Yes.
Like finding that balance. Is that an ongoing challenge for you? Or
yeah, I'm constantly, because I think I'm by nature very, like, I love being in social environments, but then I think in the past few years, as I've gotten older, I'm like realizing how important it is to recharge. And life doesn't just give you several days sometimes to just go do that, and you have to schedule it in and plan it. And so and then what I've been working on, I think too, like lately for a while, and then being more thoughtful about it lately, is just like the intention there too. Like if I don't give myself those moments to recharge, then I'm not going to be the best version of myself for my community and for my people. And so I have to go do that and take care of myself, taking care of my mental health, my well-being, sleep, do all the things so that I can be social and in that environment and be a leader too. You have to take care of yourselves. And I think the older I get, I'm like, oh, that's important. You know, so maybe I feel it more.
Well, but it's important not to downplay that. I mean, I think of my communities are all people that I respect and care about a lot, but I think a lot of them would think that you're not only aware, because awareness is a hard thing, but once you're aware, you still have to do something about it.
Exactly.
You know? So taking the time, making the time, and not just knowing what to do, like, that's hard also. So it's awareness, then what do I do about it? And then you still actually have to do it.
Yes.
You know, and I think there's that age-old adage of fortune favors the brave, you know? Mm. And so I love that you're talking about, like, bravery being really important to just self-health, you know, kind of holistic overall health. I'm interested, too, in, you know, that's all introspective. Some of your songs, again, are talking about things that are not personal to you. They're just kind of like blips in time. And I wonder if it's almost sometimes easier to write about somebody else's vulnerability, or it's easier to take a different perspective. And to me, Helen is one of those that I heard it out of context the first time, not knowing what it was about.
Yeah.
And I attributed it to a person, you know?
Absolutely.
And then when we went and, again, we studied you and looked into what that was about, it took on a different meaning, and I loved it even more. Mm. And I wonder if you could talk about that approach.
Yeah. That was another one that kind of organically came, like, happened, and then later was like, oh, that's so much of life and so many relationships were. So in the story, well, the song's about... It kind of referenced this story I'd heard, and I don't remember where I heard it.
I know where I heard it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Where did you hear it?
My daughter and I, and that's why, one reason I found it so interesting is in October, I flew out to Portland for my daughter's birthday, and we went to Mount St. Helens.
Oh, so awesome.
I was going to ask you if you'd actually been there.
I have.
Yeah, that
way
to ruin the story.
No.
Spoiler alert.
Not at all. That's one of my favorite places in the whole world. Like, the Northwest is so epic, and I think maybe because I grew up in flat Florida.
I feel the same way. I grew up in Florida, and I feel the same way about
it's so epic.
Northwest.
Yeah, it's beautiful, and I did a lot of touring up there and just hanging, and Mount St. Helens is beautiful. I think I probably heard the story up there, but for the listeners, the story is about, it's this, it's true. This guy, Harry Truman, he lived on the side of Mount St. Helens.
Not the president, by the
no,
way.
No, like, Harry, so. I think it's like Harry B.
R. Truman,
yeah. Not the president. And he lived to several, I don't know if about his whole life, but a majority of his life on the side of Mount St. Helens. And when she was about to explode, everybody was evacuating and he didn't want to leave. And there was an element to it where, like volcanoes, I'm sure, there's activity and you're like, oh, it's not going to happen. You know, there have been scares before. But I think ultimately what he was feeling was like, this was his home and this is what he knew, and he didn't want to leave it, and so he stayed, and he didn't, of course, make it. But I've read so many things about, like, he was an ornery dude. He was like, he's worth Google searching, because that's an element to, like, I think his stubbornness is another element to why he stayed. Everybody else left, and he didn't want to leave. And so there are a couple stories. I'm not remembering them right now, but that are really funny. But yeah, so the song ended up about kind of this, it almost turned into a love romantic story, whatever,
unhealthy
relationship. Yeah. With this character and the volcano, and in the song, it talks about, like, you can't, you know, it's bad for you. And this is so many things. It's not just, you know, whatever your habits, things, whatever it is. You know it's bad for you, but you can't let go of it because... And then there's a part in the song, in what, like the third verse or something, where it talks about your identity becoming that. Like, I can't leave because I don't know what I'll be if I'm not that.
Yeah.
And I think that's the more relatable thing. If it's not a relationship, whatever, but there's so many things that we identify with where we're like, this is me. This is who I am. Even healthy things like, I am a runner. I am a whatever. Mm-hmm. Like,
what would I be without that?
Yeah.
Like, you know,
and you would just be you. You're yourself. And there's so many layers to you that aren't they're not identified in things or careers. Mm-hmm. Whatever. So,
but people like to diagnose, you know.
Yeah.
People like to diagnose, and I think that that's not good or bad necessarily. Like you said, because you can identify with things that are healthy.
Yes.
You know,
and that's great. I think that's I think that's a not a bad thing. I think it's just being, it's an awareness of like, okay, well, this is a thing that I do and I love it. And
it's like emotional dependence.
Yes.
You know, and it's avoiding that.
Yeah, yeah. So the song's like definitely about that too.
Do you mind playing that one for us?
I would love to. Yeah.
I want to hear it.
I will play it for you. Soon she's gonna blow her ashes falling low. Her temperament, we've seen it all before, but she is everything I know. Smoke fills up the tree line. I didn't make it out on time. She's lighting up and soon she's gonna rise. And it is such a glorious sight. Oh, Helen, how you hurt me. But I will not deserve thee. Call me crazy. Which don't faze me, 'cause I find beauty in the suffering. Oh, Helen, my Helen, you take me to hell and back again. All the time you warned me, the signs I've been ignoring. You'll tear me down, but I could never leave, 'cause I don't know who I'd be. Oh, Helen, how you hurt me. But I crazy, oh, it don't faze me, 'cause I find beauty in the suffering. Oh, Helen, my Helen, you will take me to hell and back again. Just as you promised me. Oh, Helen, my Helen.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah.
My voice, it's, I know it was 5 years ago, but it's so different. It's funny how much a voice can change.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even our speaking voices, I think. But yeah, I feel like I'm enjoying singing more than it used to terrify me, for reals.
Yeah.
It's interesting how you say about people's voices changing, because Andrew talked a lot about finding his own voice.
Yeah.
And when we did it, and a lot of our guests, I mean, it's part of the process of songwriting,
oh, absolutely.
Right? Find your voice. But
yeah.
You know, and Martin is Australian. He's got an accent, which reminds me that, you know, for my full-time job outside of music, we work with a lot of different groups, and we'll have people go from the U.S. and live in Australia for a few years, and they come back, and they're starting to, like, they start to pick up a little bit of it. And
totally.
And I notice the more I'm listening to certain music, if I'm listening to it all the time, my voice will start to just, like, you know, just the way you curl something or the way you nuance something. And
yeah.
So even if just your timbre isn't changing, your approach and your own perception of what a voice should sound like because of what you like,
yeah.
you know, and what you're filtering probably changes your approach to it too, totally. Without you really realizing it.
And your music, like everything, I think just that's like the whole process of growing and like mm-hmm. You have to make different records and this one's going to sound different than the next one mm-hmm. and whatever. You're absorbing things in life constantly and constantly taking things and putting them in your pocket and using them later on in life in whatever capacity and in lyrics and things you absorb and style and taste. And
let's talk a little bit about, we're on that subject, about the production of the album Azalea
yeah.
and mm-hmm. who you worked with in the studio there. And then I've also heard now you've kind of established your own studio so that you
yeah.
can record
mm-hmm.
autonomously.
Yeah, that's been cool. I got to like that. It's still a work in process. progress.
What
process
was it like working with a producer on the album?
That was Jordan Lenning. He's been kind of like with the string thing too, the Lachlan Strings thing. We work really well together, and mm-hmm. we have a lot of the same dreams, I feel like, and things that we enjoy in music. And so working with him on the record was incredible. It was, I felt really heard. Like I tried to make the record that summer. That same year, and I had just come to Nashville, and I was working with a great producer, and I just didn't know what I wanted, and went in there and was like, I'll just figure it out, and mm-hmm. it just wasn't happening. And then I really knew I wanted strings on the record, and I had taken a couple months in between that process and then working with Jordan to just really record my own stuff. I demoed all of my own songs. I wrote all of the string arrangements. I just like locked myself in a room and was like, what are you doing? Like, what are you trying to make? And that was kind of like, that was the foundation then of the record. And the song, like, I just record what I know, and that's what I do in my studio too. Like, mm-hmm. I don't mix well, but I'll record everything, produce it, and then I'll send it to Jordan or whoever mm-hmm. to mix. Mm-hmm. But guitar, strings, and voices, and that's what I know, so that's what I was doing. And if it was just me, it all like 100% me. And so then taking that to Jordan and being like, this is what I want to do, but I want to do it bigger
mm-hmm.
and with somebody that has a different understanding of harmonic approach to string writing, because I was layering most of my stuff. I wasn't like writing it out. And he's a composer too, so he mm-hmm. does a lot of stuff for the Lachlan Strings thing. But his string arrangements are incredible, and he also is a producer, so it was kind of like, I should work with him. Duh.
The record sounds great.
Thank you. We did half of it at Sound Emporium in Nashville, and then he has a home studio too. That's the beautiful thing about Nashville, is everybody's got like space. You can't really do that in LA.
Right. Yeah. You want to do it at your house or my house?
Yeah, exactly.
So my neighbor's house?
Yeah. My studio is like definitely, it's a little space above my garage, and I've been I just finished making a sound diffuser, and two of my friends who are really into that stuff, like power tools and
diffusing sound.
Diffusing sound, man. Mm-hmm. They came over and we worked in my garage for like 4 days, and I learned so much. I had never used a circular saw or a nail gun, and it was so fun. And I cut like probably 900 of those little pieces for the sound diffuser, but it felt really good to do it myself. Mm-hmm. And so I want to use that space for just that, for like doing what I know and then learning more about mixing. I'd like to get better at it, but it's a time thing. And I went over to Jordan's and was like, can you just teach me? I want to sit and watch you do it. Like, we're working on a project of mine, and I was like, I just want to watch you do all the things and walk me through it. And one of the things I realized was, I have to spend a lot of money on plugins.
Well, but it's also
things.
It is in itself an instrument in a way. And
yeah,
you know, you spend
sure.
all this time going to conservatory and studying something, and if someone's like, hey, can you just teach me violin?
No,
I'm
going to
come
not.
Over for a night and learn violin, you know.
But over really over funny. And over again, also having said that, that's important for the sound you want to achieve. But at the end of the day, the most important thing is what's coming out of your
the
fingers and
the,
having a good mic and just capturing
a moment. Yeah.
Yeah. What's coming out of
absolutely.
Your you know, fingertips, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah. We did. I'm really proud of that record. I have 4 unreleased songs that I've done with him as well. And I'm like now in this process of, I really want to make another record, but mm-hmm. I'm like, I feel like the songs that I have that are unreleased are so different. And so I'm just giving myself...
Different from each other, you mean? As a batch
different from each
of songs?
Other.
Okay.
Different from each other. They could fit. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm just trying to be patient and wait and let it happen kind of organically. Like, I think the next project will kind of show itself. Like, I'm not going to force all those songs into a record. Maybe I put them out over time, whatever. And then keep writing and see what that next project mm-hmm. wants to be.
Maybe there's a full length and then maybe there's an EP
sure,
with the Misfits.
I do like the idea of full length, though. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I like that.
Talk a little bit about the EP that's coming out in May, like, because you decided to take some of the songs from...
Yeah.
Azalea and kind of rework them. What's that about?
Yeah, that's like the string versions of the record. So
it's an instrumental record.
It is an instrumental record. So I took out in my studio. Actually, I did all the string parts there, and I took out all the vocals. So all the vocal harmonies, all the words, everything, and then put violin and viola in the place of them. Mm-hmm. And I think like not all the songs I could do that with, of course. Quickly learned which ones I couldn't do. But for several of them, it really worked well. It was already so stringy and dense in the arrangements. So it just kind of provided this like really special cushion for the song, for the melody to just be in the viola part. And the vocals are so similar to string instruments anyways. So how many songs? Like, maybe 8 or something, 7 or 8. And half of them are just instrumentals. And then there are 3 that are from a live session that I did with just me and string quintet. And yeah, so why not? I feel like I had this idea, like after I made the record, I was like, man, I just spent a lot of time and also a lot of money on this. So how do I capitalize on that and just keep it going? And so, and I have a studio and it was really fun. It was definitely like harder than I thought at times because just the intonation would really just bug me. I'd sit there and do it forever and
that's
it'd be 3 parts.
Conservatory
and,
background.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Rearing its head.
I'd have to step away and be like, this is, and that's the, I think a lot of artists when they produce their own stuff fall into the same trap of like getting so in it. And you need sometimes an extra pair of ears to be like, dude, that sounds great.
Right.
You're crazy.
Right.
And it drove me a little crazy. There was one particularly, Helen drove me crazy, actually.
As the song implies.
As
the irony.
Song,
yeah.
All the irony.
So while we're still at process, which is something we ask all of our guests, we're trying to take a tally here. Are you a lyrics first, music first, or title first writer?
I think I do it differently each time.
Little everything.
Yeah,
huh?
Like lyrics, if I have like a nugget, like a... there's a songwriting teacher at Berkeley that used to call it a song seed. Mm. When you have like an idea and you, my phone has just nuggets of just stupid things, fine things, whatever things that I might never use. But if
these
I have
little audio clips, you mean like,
just words sometimes
notes,
like,
notes, okay.
Oh, that's a cool concept for an idea for a song. Mm-hmm. Like, I get them a lot when I'm running, and I'll just stop and like write one down. But voice memos too. But I usually don't do that. I don't do that as much. I guess then maybe most of the time I do start with the words.
Mm-hmm. I was gonna say if someone had asked me to guess, because the vocabulary that you're using is really great. Helen's a good example of, you know, using you know, I Will Not Desert Thee to come back, and the way you rhyme that is great. But even just some of your interspersed between the songs, like some of the words that you use, I really enjoyed. You used the word folkloric last night.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like, that one really stuck in my head. I was like, oh, it's a keeper.
The first one time I said that live, I was like, or show, I was like, is that, that's a word, right?
Yeah. Fact checking. If it's not, they should consider it.
I often do slide in.
I knew what
word,
it meant
word.
Immediately. Yeah. So it had its intended.
I thought it was Scottish profanity.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if said in that accent, it almost
it's quite possible
Scottish
that that I used it in the wrong way. But it worked, and if you say anything confidently, you know, it floats
without question. Yeah,
yeah.
In terms of, you know, trying to make it in the music industry these days, because it's part of what this podcast is about. You're on tour. You're a touring musician. Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit about your community, well, a lot of bit about your community and what you're doing in Nashville. What are the things that you think are challenges that you feel like you're figuring out how to overcome or that you're not sure about yet? And what are the things you think you're intentionally doing that are helping you continue to have a place in the industry and push yourself forward and make a living and career out of it?
Mm, that's a good question. I think balance is the thing that, like, balancing everything is something that I have to constantly work on, and boundaries. Where, like, I'm really feeling like I'm going into this place of creating that I have a desire that to do that at this point. Like, it's time. And making sure I have time to do that, because there's so many aspects of all of it. And I think I'm one of maybe the few people that likes the business side of it. Mm-hmm. I understand it, or I respect it. I do have a team that gets it more than I do, but I enjoy thinking about that. And so compartmentalizing all of the aspects of it and making sure that, okay, this is your allotted time to put yourself into the business aspect of it and think about that. Don't be, let yourself be there and not overwhelmed by it. And then when you go to create, be there fully, being like fully present in that, and not worrying, not letting the things seep into each other, and just keeping it separate. And same with, because I now have a lot of different projects, so making sure that I allot time for each of them. And I think that's a big challenge, because I have to be writing and like creating and saving that precious thing and making sure I have energy and time to do that. And
right.
So making sure that balance is always at the forefront of everything. And I think what's going well. I mean, I think one thing that, because I do a lot of different things, I've been patient. And I'm just excited about all of the things, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm never like, man, I really want a booking agent tomorrow. Or mm-hmm. I wish I had, like, I'm just kind of like, whatever happens is going to be great, and everything, it's been growing steadily, and I've been enjoying the whole process thoroughly. Like, there's been rough, you know, there's mm-hmm. been bumps, mm-hmm. but I think that's been one thing that when I can... being patient throughout all of it.
Have you at any point been, and I ask this as a male, a white male in the industry, conscious or aware of the fact that you are female in the industry? Have you felt like it's balanced, it's kind of, it doesn't really matter in this industry? Because there's certainly a lot of talk about that in a lot of the mm-hmm. award shows about underrepresentation of minorities and women, and certainly, you know, you mentioned business, you know, it's certainly in the workforce, that's still a huge issue.
Yeah.
I'm curious what your take is on that.
I have so many, because I've done so many different things, like seen different sides of the music, this weird thing, I have seen and experienced different aspects of it. Like, as a violin player who's playing for Rod Stewart, you know, like the wardrobe you must wear, and as an artist, I've felt respected by my community, and as a leader in my community, I've felt respected as a woman and powerful because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's also because I feel like I've surrounded myself, the guys that I work with a lot of men, and they all respect me as an equal. But That's not, it hasn't always happened that way. And I think for me, the thing that annoys me the most is when I have done the string things and you're looked at as an image, as just the, I don't know, eye candy or whatever, like, rather than the talent.
Really?
Yeah.
Like in the, you're speaking specifically of like, backing up Rod Stewart or
that wasn't a horrible, it wasn't a bad experience,
but even but in like in I the classical it. World or
not in
saying?
The classical okay, world. Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean it's very much
asexual.
Yeah.
Cuz I would have found that surprising. So.
But I mean my mom was a classical conductor and she was one of the only female classical conductors and she had to, you know, like especially when she was coming up, like that she experienced that in the classical world all the time and just I feel like you just have to have like a strong backbone and be like, no, I'm doing this and I'm going to do it really well. But she also had a lot of great male relationships, I think, of fellow conductors or people that respected what she did. Mm-hmm. And yeah, but I mean, I'd like to see, I have these conversations all the time with like female friends, whatever, my guy friends too, of like, it's in Nashville. There's so many backing bands, and mine too, of males, like dudes. Mm-hmm. Like, where are the like chicks that are shredding on guitar? And there are some, and they're really badass. And I want to see them more. And I gotta get them to play on my stuff.
Right.
But it is funny, and I was talking to I think Andrew and the guys. Like, it's sometimes not even like a. It's another thing to be intentional about and be aware of when I'm choosing my band. Like I do often like choose my friends and a lot of them are and people that I know have a certain sound. They happen to be guys. But if I want to if I'm aware of that and I want to be intentional about trying to make that change, then I should be seeking out like I know a handful in Nashville, but yeah, I should be seeking out and promoting that change too. And it happens a lot more in LA. Like you see a lot more women drummers, and people want that actually more. But Nashville's slowly kind of, and even in the session world, like strings, it's different. It's not. They're women. It's split down the middle.
Well, speaking as an adult adolescent, I've heard plenty gentlemen say, you know, like. The adage of, I'm going to pick up an instrument so I can attract women. I mean, even Ronnie Elliott, who's one of our guests who we absolutely loved, is, you know, mentioned, he said, yeah, I thought it would be a good way to, you know, potentially meet people. I haven't heard a lot of my female colleagues say, like, I learned guitar so I could pick up dudes.
I have never heard that.
Right.
I mean, that's why I picked up the viola, but I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Total guy magnet.
Just, they're just
viola.
Lining up, man.
I think that just might be they don't know how to pronounce viola.
Probably. Voila.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so funny. That's true. I've never heard that. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I think it's just kind of where we've come from in music. It's kind of, but I think I'm hopeful that things keep growing and changing, and the more conversations we have about it, the more. There are a lot of like young girls that I know that are, there's a lot of programs and there are different programs in Nashville. Girls Write Nashville is one, like empowering young women to be musicians in this music industry and confident and like go play drums, do it. And, I don't know, just like building their confidence in it and go be a producer, go whatever. Like, it's funny, the women that I have worked with a lot, like several women producers, female producers, and sometimes we feel the need to put like an edge of like a little hardness on, a toughness, because there is that divide. And I've worked with several women where I'm like, dang, you tough. All right, I won't be on your bedside. But also, they're doing it for a purpose.
Right.
So, I don't know. That's not usually my approach. I'm not really, I can be tough, but I think there's a beauty in working with other people too, mm-hmm. because yes. like for me, even for co-writes and stuff, like there's a beauty in co-writes because you're working with somebody that has a different set of skills than you. Mm-hmm. So you're challenging yourself. Like every time I write with this guy, Anthony DaCosta, a lot. And he always just challenges me, like with writing. With he's a way better guitar player.
He's incredible.
Okay, so you know him. Yeah, no, he's.
We know him.
Yeah. I mean, I've geeked out on YouTube, like, because he'll do like product demos and stuff.
Oh, too.
I want one of those pedals.
He's the reason I have the Waterloo.
I stole
his Waterloo for three months.
I totally get that. I get that.
And yeah. I was like, Anthony, give me your guitar. I love it. And I fell in love with it. And then, but he's since told me that he's envious of mine. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You got a good one.
I got a really good one.
Special one.
Yeah, but he constantly challenges me. In that world, because guitar's not my first instrument, and like I'm constantly learning, like, oh, that's a chord. I didn't know if I put my hands there would make that sound.
Yeah, that's how I learned.
It's a different, like, it's the strings are so linear, so mm-hmm. it's different to conceptualize. So, yeah, I think it's really great to work with other people, and just constantly stretches you as an artist and person and musician.
So, Lydia, in terms of what you have coming up, mm-hmm. what do you want people to go listen to? What do you have coming up? What should they be looking for? And what are you hoping to get done in the next 1 to 5 years?
Wow, that's a lot of years. I want to make another record soon. So this summer I'm writing a lot, but I'm putting out that EP in May. And then I have several shows this summer just here in Nashville, L.A. I go back to L.A. a lot and write and work out there. Just to change up the scene and like the songwriters and write with different people. But I'm doing a UK tour in September that's like 4 or 5 weeks, and that'll be really fun. I'm opening for Sam Outlaw. I don't know if you know him. I used to play fiddle in his band. He's like country Americana. Mm-hmm. And I'll be playing with him as well. And I really love what I'm doing. In all of the things, like the Lachlan Strings things, everything. I love the different aspects of like my music career. It's so weird and it's so just me and different, and like it makes me feel really fulfilled. I just want to be doing what I'm doing, like, you know, times whatever in mm-hmm, 5 years. And I say that now, but there could be like, you know, a whole nother thing, another project, whatever. But I'm really into like the Lachlan Strings things and everything that's going on. So I just want to keep just letting it kind of organically unfold and see what happens. And yeah, man, keep playing, keep shredding on viola. I do have this idea of like maybe one day I'd audition as a sub for the symphony, but then also that kind of stresses me out thinking about it.
Well, Lydia, we wish you luck with whatever you approach.
And thank you.
Congrats on all the success so far, and yeah. a wonderful performance last night.
Thank you so
two
much.
New yes. and yep. and really happy fans
awesome.
Right. of yours yep. for sure.
Thank you guys so much for having
yeah,
me.
This thank
was
you.
So fun. Yeah.
Come back and see you soon.
I would love to. It's right. nice here.
We'll see you later.
Bye. You call me when you're home. It's cold out tonight, and you're all alone. Are you afraid of the dark? Or do you live by the light in your heart?
You've been listening to Song Divers.
Thank you for supporting us and our sponsors and all the great independent music makers out there trying to make their way in the music business these days. Songs we heard in this episode were Strawberry Moon, Helen, and Azalea, all from Lydia's Azalea album, and Love You True from her EP, The Tides.
To hear more of Lydia Luce, follow her on Spotify, Facebook, and Instagram, all under Lydia Luce.
That's LYDIALUCE.
Head to LydiaLuce.com to follow her tours. And if you want more of her string work, follow Lachlan Strings on Instagram to see if you can land a seat at one of their intimate NPR acclaimed shows. Lachlan is spelled LOCKELAND.
She heavily influenced this record. I think my old roommate is a songwriter, and she just gave me this poem about, it was her whale poem. It's talking about a whale song, but it, like, finding your voice and being your own person, but it's also a metaphor with an ocean animal. So she was like, you're gonna love this naturally.
Song Divers is a production of Ybor City Records and recorded in the historic Kenwood district of St. Petersburg, Florida.